The headline, Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel faces growing criticism for failing to reverse the rise in coronavirus infections in the country. The family lawyer of George Floyd, an African-American killed by a white police officer in 2020, says that his murder trial is a referendum on American justice. And Iran reacts to Washington's expression of concern about Tehran-Beijing ties, saying the flourishing of strategic cooperation in the East is accelerating the U.S. decline. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital of Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel faces heavy criticism for her government's lack of a clear plan to curb rising coronavirus infections. Merkel has raised the possibility of obliging states to implement measures ordered by the federal government, but she has failed to outline those measures, drawing accusations from opposition parties that she is clueless. Last week, a top health authority warned of a five-fold jump in new cases to 100,000 a day if the current infection rate goes unchecked. In response, Merkel called for more shutdowns amid a sluggish vaccination campaign and her government's inability to offer a clear timetable out of the crisis. The World Health Organization has warned against a widening gap in coronavirus vaccine distribution across the globe. The WHO chief, Tedros Adhanom, says that there is a growing gap between jabs distributed in rich countries and poor countries through the COVAX initiative. He denounced the unfair distribution of vaccines, saying it is economically and epidemiologically self-defeating. It follows the criticism by the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres of the developed countries for creating a stockpile of COVID-19 vaccines. Guterres said the COVAX international system of vaccine aid to disadvantaged countries is having difficulties because, quote, there has been a lot of hoarding. Figures show more than half of the COVID-19 vaccines have been administered in high-income countries, which account for only 16% of the global population. Hello, welcome. Time now for the news review of this bulletin. The lawyer of slain African-American man George Floyd says the trial of the officer responsible for his death is a referendum on the U.S. justice system.
Today starts a landmark trial that will be a referendum on how far America has come in its quest for equality and justice for all.
Opening arguments in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the white police officer charged with killing Floyd, began in Minneapolis on Monday. Trump warned that the defense in the trial will try to impugn the victim's reputation to defend Chauvin. The officer knelt on Floyd's neck during an arrest on May 25, 2020, for more than 8 minutes before he lost consciousness and died. The incident, which was filmed by bystanders, rocked the U.S. and led to widespread protests against police mistreatment of African Americans. Chloe Campbell is our correspondent from Washington, D.C., who joins us to give us the latest on that. And we also have Omali Yeshitela, who's the founder of Uhuru Movement, who joins us from St. Petersburg, Florida. Colin, at this point, we've heard the opening statement that is ongoing by the lawyer. I forget his name, Jerry. I forget his last name.
Benjamin Crump. Benjamin Crump.
And Crump, exactly. What type of coverage will we see? Is it going to be widespread? We heard the judge talk about the daily coverage that's going to happen. Is that how the media outlets across the states will cover this?
Yeah, most definitely. As we know that this is going to be a much anticipated trial in the prosecution of Derek Chauvin, and to see if there will really be any justice. Of course, ultimate justice won't be served because George Floyd will still be dead, but will there be as close as there can be to justice with the prosecution and the incarceration of a former police officer who is accused of killing an unarmed black man? So many times we've seen this happen over and over again, ending in an acquittal where some police are able to return to their jobs, where they get really a slap on the wrist for taking the life of an individual who is unarmed. Well, with the opening arguments that we heard from prosecuting attorney Jerry Blackwell and from the prosecuting team, we have heard that they are going to bring in a myriad of experts talking about how the knee on the back of George Floyd for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. I know this is a little bit different timing than we've heard repeated over and over again, but according to the prosecuting attorney, it was almost 9.5 minutes that the knee was on the back of George Floyd, and how that could have led to his death. Most of us already have seen the video, but for some of these jury members, they may not be as familiar as a lot of Americans are. And they'll bring in experts, they'll bring in members of various police, the police force, to talk about policing policies and how Chauvin didn't follow them. They'll bring in medical experts to talk about the stress that was put on Floyd's system. They said that this will, and that how it all came about, the counterfeit $20 bill, and not even really saying that George Floyd knew that the bill was counterfeit, that it could have been just a violation, a misdemeanor, where he could have been given a ticket and the courts could have totally processed this claim, and that could have been the end of it. But what it led to, obviously, was Floyd's death over a $20 bill that could or could not have been counterfeit. And we'll hear from this, and this will definitely be covered by the media throughout the next several days, if not weeks.
Okay, Amani Yeshitela, obviously the stage is set now. We're looking at this trial. The world is watching. And you have had the family lawyer who talked about this say that this is going to be a trial that is a referendum of the American justice system. Do you think justice is going to prevail?
I think if we recognize that the United States government has a colonial relationship with African people in the United States, then we can say justice will prevail, but it will be the justice of a colonizer, because the colonizer is incapable of actually bringing justice to the colonized. And if we want to look at a referendum for the American justice system, I think the May 25th murder of George Floyd represents a part of the referendum on the justice system, just as the murder of Mike Brown, just as the murder of so many other Africans who I've spoken to you about over the last few years. It happens regularly, happens all the time, and it is justice from their perspective. There is an entire industry that has grown up where entrepreneurs, in particular lawyers, make a lot of money off of these murders. And even the discussion about this as some kind of referendum of justice is something that suggests that the American justice system, as it's characterized, is usually something that can be seen as okay, but this will be a defining issue, and it's never okay. And so there's no way that there's anything that can be said that will bring justice to the case of Floyd or any other Africans who live under this U.S. vicious U.S. colonial domination.
You know, when you take a look at what has happened, and I know this has been discussed before and it has been hashed out, but this really should be an open and shut case. I mean, the proof is in the video. It's very clear that in 9 minutes, 29 seconds, the way that officer was kneeling on George Floyd's neck, that it led to his death, no matter what the charge could be. And I'm not saying that this Chauvin officer, former police officer, shouldn't get a fair trial. But given the fact that this, again, appears that it's pretty much something that was done on purpose by that officer, at least to the general public. What would happen if this officer, for any reason, is not going to be charged with the maximum charge that has to be leveled against them, given the fact that it's a very sensitive time in the U.S.? Amalia Shutella.
It is not something where we've seen the maximum charge being offered. I mean, there's no first-degree murder charge here, which means intentional. And it is clear that you cannot rest your knee and your entire body weight on somebody's neck without intending to kill them. There's no way that can be seen otherwise. And it is a clear-cut case. And the problem that we are confronted with as Africans in this country all the time is, no matter, we have a whole history of murder and brutality, but in every instance, we treat every incident like this incident as something where the Africans, the victims of the murder, has to prove that we are not guilty of something. Even the suggestion that this murder had something to do with a counterfeit $20 bill. And I'm reminded of Mike Brown. He's killed. And then there's a suggestion that earlier on he had stolen some cigars. And this is thrown into the mix without any evidence of this having anything to do with why he was killed. And it had nothing to do with why he was killed. So it's a clear-cut case. An African see it as clear-cut. We experience it on a regular daily basis in the United States. It's clear-cut. And that's part of what I mean when we talk about a referendum on the justice system in the United States, this trial being a referendum for whom? The African population knows what this means. That's why after George Floyd was murdered on May 25th, from May 25th through August, there was something like 10,000 or more rebellions, uprising, protests that happened in this country because African people do recognize, and the referendum has already occurred as far as we're concerned about the American justice system where African people are involved.
Okay, Colin, if we still have you, what is the, at this point, the charge leveled against Chauvin, and what is the maximum sentencing that he can get?
This is something that I believe prosecutors will be trying to seek very fervently because of the fact that they know that the history behind these cases, there is no first-degree murder charge, which would have given him the maximum time, life imprisonment. But again, these three charges altogether, if he's found guilty on all of them, would effectively give him that same sentence.
Okay, Amalia Yeshitala, my final question to you. You know, in the U.S., the violence against African Americans, and in many cases that violence that leads to death, it practically happens on a daily basis. Why is it that those cases are not highlighted in order to lead for a decrease when it comes to the police violence against African Americans? Again, an issue that has been hashed out and has been talked about, but yet it continues.
Yeah, the thing is, clearly, with all of this murder happening and the protests and the mobilizations that occur as a consequence of the murder, politically, it would make sense for the police to refrain from this kind of murder, or at least to certainly not be doing it as often as they do it, but they can't help it. And they can't help it. They have to do it. Because in order to keep a people under colonial domination, extreme violence is necessary. It's a necessary factor. Police, we have here in the United States, a public policy of police containment of the African community, period. Not economic development, not anything that you would think would occur if a country were actually involved in trying to do the right thing by a part of the population. But it can't. And the reason it hasn't decreased is because they can't decrease. And they can't decrease because they cannot control a population of several million people under the most brutal, extreme circumstances, poverty, starvation, poor health care, all of this without the utilization of extreme violence. And the police department is that instrument of the state, the colonial state that maintains this oppression of African people. That's why they do it. That's why they can't not do it. And also, generally speaking, when it happens, they're able to win acquittals only because there is an assumption in the general white population of America that something must be wrong with black people that justifies this kind of treatment by the police, by the state. This is what we are looking at. And I'm encouraged by the fact that we saw after Floyd's murder, there were so many of the uprising and protests. We saw a growing number of the colonizer population, white people themselves, who joined under the leadership of the African people. And so I'm encouraged. I don't look for anything to come from the government, but from the organization, the protests, the mobilization of the people, that's the thing that might make a difference, not the U.S. government itself.
Very well. Thank you very much for that. Mali Yeshitala, founder of Uhuru Movement, from St. Petersburg, Florida. Also like to thank Colin Campbell, our correspondent there, who was talking to us from Washington, D.C. Thanks to both of you. And that brings us to the end of this news review. The U.S. president has expressed concern about the newly signed Iran-China Comprehensive Partnership Agreement.
How concerning is the emerging partnership between China and Iran?
I've been concerned about that for a year.
Biden made the comment in an address to reporters in the U.S. city of Wilmington. Tehran and Beijing signed a cooperation pact, dubbed the Sino-American Strategic Partnership. The deal was signed during a visit by China's foreign minister, Wang Yi, to Iran. The agreement includes cooperation in political, strategic, and economic fields. The secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, meanwhile, has reacted to Biden's comment. Ali Shamfani says Biden's concern is correct, as the flourishing of strategic cooperation in the East is accelerating the U.S. decline. Writer and political commentator John White says U.S. President Joe Biden is concerned about the Iran-China deal because it goes against Washington's anti-Tehran sanctions and pressure.
Biden says he's been concerned about this growing relationship between Iran and China for some time. Let's be clear what he's concerned about. He's concerned about Iranian children having food on the table, and he would rather they did not have food on the table, because this, when all is taken into context, is what this is really about. The Iranian people have been suffering the depredations of U.S. Caesar sanctions, as have the Venezuelan people, as have the Cuban people for over half a century, and as are the Syrian people as we speak. And Anthony Blinken and Joe Biden have succeeded within 100 days of their administration being in office of poisoning relations between the U.S. and Russia to an all-time low, which is really saying something, and poisoning relations between Washington and Beijing to an all-time low, which is really saying something, though for different reasons than his predecessor, Donald J. Trump. So when it comes to human rights, the U.S. has no leg to stand on. Indeed, a million Iraqi dead, thousands of Libyan dead, the people who are suffering the depredations of the sanctions I just described in Iran and Venezuela and Cuba, they make clear that the U.S. has no right to lecture any country on human rights at any time, anywhere.
China says it welcomes a visit by U.N. officials to the Xinjiang region amid a row with the West over the alleged abuse of the country's Uyghur Muslim minority there.
The door to Xinjiang is always open. We welcome the visit of the U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights to Xinjiang. China has already issued an invitation to the High Commissioner for Human Rights to visit China and visit Xinjiang. The two sides have been in communication. The purpose of the visit is to promote exchanges and cooperation between the two parties and not to carry out so-called investigations based on presumption of guilt.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry made the reaction after the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for unfettered access to Xinjiang to verify reports of human rights abuses in the region. Meanwhile, officials in Xinjiang accused Western countries of trying to contain China under the pretext of human rights issues.
The European Union, the United States, the United Kingdom and Canada have ganged up to use Xinjiang-related issues to engage in political manipulation. The goal is to mess up Xinjiang and contain China under the guise of human rights.
The Chinese officials slammed unilateral sanctions against Xinjiang as aimed at undermining the region's stability and hindering China's development. Several Western nations and the European Union have imposed sanctions on China, accusing Beijing of violating the rights of Uyghurs in camps in Xinjiang. China has reacted by imposing retaliatory sanctions. Beijing says the rights violation allegations have been leveled with the aim of spreading lies and disinformation. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
from the very heart of evergreen forests. Under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. About living lonely in a deserted island? Yes, I know, it's a kind of like fantasy, exists just in movies. However, today I'm going to take you to an amazing island in the Caspian Sea. You might ask yourself whether the Caspian Sea has an island, and then I'll tell you yes, it has an island called Ashurada. Ashurada Island is the only island of the Iranian coast of the Caspian Sea. This island is located in Miankale and is 10 kilometers to Bandar Turkaman. Being equipped with facilities like gendarmerie, school, shops, mosque, and Husseiniye since many years ago, Ashurada Island was home to more than 1,000 people who used to do animal husbandry, constructing and fishing. However, after the island was flooded in 1993, the locals left the island. Ashurada initially consisted of three islands, but the sea tide submerged the two other islands, and today only one island is left. Ashurada Island's vegetation includes raspberry bushes, sour pomegranate trees, to name a few, and its wilderness consists of fox, jackal, rabbit, fish, seabirds, pheasant and partridge. Also a type of boar as well as a type of wild horse live in the island that are able to drink salty seawater. I am now in Bandar Turkaman. Just beside me there is a pier with boats around. Here, there is also a small market which sells handicrafts. And here, oh look, Turkaman traditional outfits. I love these beautiful colorful guns. And of course, these scarves with their special designs and patterns. I'll buy one of these scarves for my grandma after my visit to the island. Now, heading to the Ashurada Island. The sound of sea waves and the noise oars make with water is really pleasant. How calm it is! And the salty smell of the sea. are in Ashurada Island. More beautiful than what I had imagined in my mind. Oh, God. There are so many birds in here. And among them, flamingo. Ashurada is a kind of, like, hangout for migrating birds. And look at there. Wild horses. They're really gorgeous. And before I forget, let me tell you something. Ashurada doesn't have any hotel or residence. This place has only a coffee shop, which I'm going to taste its tea after roaming in the island. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Gentlemen, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region of South Asia as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people. Please stay with us.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the Persian New Year, or Nowruz, and the various forms it is celebrated across the subcontinent. And we shall discuss the ancient Iranian festival as a platform for closer cooperation and interaction throughout the globe.
Since the beginning of humanity, people from all throughout the globe have had some form of spring fest to celebrate the reappearance of life. For many civilizations, it is called Nowruz. Nowruz, which literally means new day in Persian, has traveled to all corners of the planet and put on different costumes and traits. Blended with different cultures and communities through history, today, Nowruz has shared a story narrated with myriad of nuances by all those who know it.
Nowruz marks the start of spring and is a celebration of nature and environment. But it has survived history and passed across geography because it means so much more than a mere seasonal festival. It is a fantastic collection of traditions and a system of values shared by many civilizations across the globe.
The celebration of Nowruz is basically the celebration of nature. The changes we have with the change of the season, we see that traditional philosophical traditions, people believe that their life, their beliefs are influenced by the natural surroundings, and there are many such thinkings.
Nowruz has changed and is still changing like a living and dynamic organism, but its core human values has remained through old traditions for more than 3,000 years. Spreading messages like hope, revival and diversity all over the world, Nowruz is celebrated almost everywhere, from Balkans to the Black Sea Basin, from the Caucasus to Central Asia, from the Middle East all through the subcontinent to the shores of the Pacific Ocean.
All these countries, particularly in Asia, they celebrate Nowruz, but there are local elements. Nowruz is celebrated in India, in different parts of India, but we have also similar celebration like Nowruz. We have Holi, we have Basant, and they have a different whole cultural background and its epistemology. But even the Nowruz that is celebrated in India has Indian and local elements.
According to the United Nations, today Nowruz festivities are held by over 300 million people in Iran, Kosovo, Georgia, Tajikistan, Albania, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, and parts of India and Pakistan. The Kurdish populations of Turkey, Iraq and Syria, as well as the Turkic community in western China, also celebrate the ancient Iranian fest.
The United Nations family celebrates Nowruz because this holiday has meaning for the whole world. Nowruz is a reminder of all that we have in common and the richness of our diversity.
Nowruz, like many other remnants of our mythological past, is a variegated palette of symbols and concepts that were created to remind us ideas like commonalities of life and death, the re-emergence of hope, and unity alongside diversity. Well, anyone who has ever lived or even visited, for example, India or Pakistan, knows well that the subcontinent is all about unity alongside diversity.
Nowruz is celebrated on the day of the astronomical vernal equinox. In stories, it marks the victory of King Jamshid against a killer mythological winter, but the reality is simpler. It marks the spring equinox, that is the moment the sun crosses the celestial equator and equalizes night and day. It may be one of the early things humans noticed about the cycle of life on their planet. Solstices and equinoxes are easily observable astronomical patterns. For the pastoralists of ancient Asian steppes, it was only an indicator of changing seasons. The spring equinox may have not enjoyed the significance and ritual connotations in the early days. However, Nowruz rose to prominence over time only after the first Indo-Europeans became settled farmers, when they began to use the spring celebration as the start of the planting seasons for sowing and harvesting crops. There is consensus among linguists and scholars that the word is a later name for the festival. The older name for the holiday was Navosardo, which meant New Year.
Nowruz is a day of celebrating life. On this day, people welcome the coming of spring, which symbolizes life. We believe that the warmth of life returns to the land during this season.
The United Nations has officially announced Nowruz as an international holiday. According to the official UN document, it promotes values of peace and solidarity between generations and within families, as well as reconciliation and neighborliness, contributing to the cultural diversity and friendship among peoples and different communities. Nowruz plays a significant role in strengthening the cordial relations among peoples based on mutual respect and the ideals of peace and good neighborliness.
Nowruz is not a mere holiday. It is comprised of a set of ideas. If you focus on its deep human fundamentals, Nowruz may be able to go beyond a traditional festival. It may work as uniting force between the East and the West.
I have my very beautiful experience in Iran celebrating Nowruz. And Iran, as we see as our second home, once I was there around 5 years ago on the occasion of Nowruz, I visited my friend's home, and it was very pleasant to see the elders giving EV to youngers, and I too received the similar gift from the elders. And there was all celebration, people coming to see each other, having food, and celebrating, and it was a great moment and a great time.
Nowruz was developed by Zoroastrians, but spread across the subcontinent mostly by Muslims. While in northern India, this festival's inception dates back to the Mughal era in western India. The festivity was brought by the Parsi community. It is among the rare occasions when arch rivals Pakistan and India congratulate each other. There is a shared positive sense about it.
The festival of Nowruz has a special significance in Kashmir. It's celebrated here with great fervor. Nowruz celebrations here date back to pre-Islamic times, but after the arrival of Islamic scholars from Persian who introduced Islam here, the festival gained importance and has become an integral part of our rich cultural heritage.
Such an aspect can potentially create a platform for more positive interactions among different nations and governments. It may come to serve as a friendly vessel for better communication between New Delhi and Islamabad.
Well, we can say that Nowruz is a kind of soft power we have in this region to connect the people of the whole region. If we say about India and Indian subcontinent, it is basically the region of celebrations, because we have different cultural identities, hundreds of the cultural identities, and they have their own festivities, beliefs, and cultural traditions. Nowruz was adopted and welcomed because it coincides with many of Indian celebrations. As I mentioned, Basant being celebrated in January, and Holi is being celebrated sometime in February or in early March. And similarly, we have other festivities, and we have Zoroastrians here, the migrants, they are called as Parsis. They do celebrate it, Nowruz. Vis-a-vis, they also have their own Shahanshahi calendar that comes in August, yet they do celebrate in Nowruz on the same time, celebrated everywhere. And we see the variations also. And there are also people in Bangladesh, in Dhaka, the Nawab family of Dhaka, in Hyderabad, in Gujarat, in Bombay, the Parsi people, even in Delhi. And for the whole Turkish period in India, that was for around 800 years, they had celebrated it. It was introduced in 13th century by Balban, who basically copied it from the Iranian tradition, and he himself tried to imposter himself being the descendant of Iranian great kings of Shahnama. So there has been a great tradition, and there is assimilation of the local elements.
The subcontinent has numerous regional and religious events survive throughout the various parts of history or mythology. For instance, Pongal is a multi-day Tamil harvest festival in South India, and Holi is the popular Hindu festival of spring. But for many, Nowruz has been added to the calendar because it covers them all. The multi-week cultural festival is a compact combination of feasts and fetes that in other parts of the world are presented in dozens of holidays and occasions scattered all along the year.
Nowruz is celebrated globally as the symbol of life and peace, but people in many of the countries that celebrate Nowruz are suffering from extreme distresses of war. During war and peace, famine and plague, and even now with this horrible pandemic, people tend to find the moment to notice and admire the return of spring. Applied in proper channels, Nowruz may be helpful in more political aspects. Imagine weeks of spring holidays for all those undergoing some sort of struggles, skirmishes, or other conflicts. In almost all cultures and countries over the planet, sprouted seeds, like wheat and barley, play a central role in the rituals surrounding the return of life and end of darkness. With a cooperative spirit, Nowruz can bring light to the life of many of those who are longing for a blossom of hope.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight and analysis, we are joined by Professor Syed Ainul Hassan. He's the Dean of School of Language, Literature and Cultural Studies at Jawaharlal Nehru University. Professor Hassan, welcome to the show. So, how can Nowruz play a role in uniting the people? Can it serve as a framework for better interaction among countries?
First of all, I would like to extend my best wishes to all sisters and brothers who celebrate Nowruz. As a matter of fact, Nowruz symbolizes a particular historical event. But that event is not just confined to one section of society or one sect of people. Rather, the message is too big and too vast. And you know, it was Jamshid who defeated devils, and people from all walks of life, from all over the world, went to congratulate him. They presented gifts to Jamshid. On what basis? Basically, it was victory of good over evil, and therefore, the world community, even today, is searching for some peace plan, and that peace plan can come after the defeat of evildoers. Those who have the best script and best spirit, good spirit, for them, you see, it's all right. But those who do not possess this, I mean, they should be defeated. This is the purpose of the entire world. And therefore, this is very much relevant today, that this message can only combine the entire community of the world together.
All right, so what subcontinental feats of culture or tradition have been added to Nowruz in India and Pakistan?
Well, this is somewhat a highly political matter. And instead of, you see, making any remark on this particular issue, I am purely a person, you see, involved in academics. I see everything through academics. But well, India has been trying very hard to acknowledge relevance of other people, other stakeholders, and therefore no country is left out. You know, our Prime Minister visited a large number of countries, and instead of having any kind of grudge, rather it was very, very peaceful and peace-inviting visits. And therefore, I believe that Indian government will definitely move forward again and again in this direction.
All right, Mr. Hassan, before moving ahead, let's just please take a quick look at how the global media has covered Nowruz, and then we can continue.
Nowruz traces its origins in the Iranian and Indian tradition of celebrating the season of regeneration. The origin of Nowruz celebrations has been mentioned in various historical accounts all over the world, but mostly in Muslim countries, both in Shia and Sunni communities. Most popularly celebrated in Maharashtra and Gujarat, the Persian New Year is known as Nowruz or Pateti and marks the beginning of the Iranian calendar. The holy occasion of the Iranian New Year's Day is commemorated around the world by celebrating with the spirit of love, peace, positivity, and prayer. Nowruz celebrations are sometimes known as Nowruz Jamshidi. According to the myth, Jamshid was carried through the air in a chariot, a feat that so amazed his subjects that they established a festival on that day. Similar mythological narratives exist in Indian and Turkish traditions, while the legend of Amu Nowruz is popular in the countries of Central Asia. In the 18th century, a rich tradesman from Surat, Nasir Vanji Kuhyaji, who often traveled to Iran, came to know about Nowruz and began celebrating the day back home that brought the festival to India. In the 19th century, another Parsi, Murwanji Pandey, started celebrating the day in Mumbai after his wife, who was from Iran, told him about it.
All right, Professor, welcome back. So, people from different races, ethnicities, and religions celebrate Nowruz or some kind of festival for spring. What is so innate within humans that they feel joyful or elated with the change of season?
That's a very, very, important question today. What is happening in all Indian festivals are based on change of season. And in Iran also, it is the 21st March or Awwal-e Farvard, meaning change of season from one set to another. But let me tell you, most important thing is that, it happened, during the ancient time. And people migrated to India, like, Parsis. Some people say in 7th century and some say that later centuries. But what they did, they preserved their ancient culture. They brought their ancient culture with them to India. And similarly, during Balban's time, there were a large number of Persians present at the court of Balban, the Delhi Sultan. And therefore, Balban also started this festival. What? It has, basically a cultural root. And therefore, Balban wanted to combine all people together for this festivity. But later on, see, as people mentioned, and the historians also have mentioned, that it was Aurangzeb who somehow became more, rigid and in terms of religious activities, and therefore he disbanded Nowruz. But today, people in different states of India and outside India also, there are as many as, and I've learned that more than 40 countries celebrate Nowruz. So you can see the message of Nowruz and the importance of Nowruz. It is, if we confine it to the change of season only, then you see, it becomes in Europe and America, there is a different season. And today, here you see in India, in Iran and other places, what I say, the message is so strong, combining all people together. But yes, there is a community, Shia community, believes that 21st, what is the relevance of 21st March? They believe that this was the day when Prophet Muhammad announced the name of his successor, which is pointed towards, Ghadir-e Khum and what happened there. So this also becomes a relevance that, there is a change of seat, change of power from one to another. And very amicably, there is a change of power. This is how you can find so many relevance, not one single. It's the first day of new calendar, this is also a relevance. In India, there is Holi, which will follow immediately after Nowruz, you will find holy celebration where people throw colors on each other to friends and foes, distribute sweets, exchange flowers. And this is the time when best flowers are seen, whether in Iran or India. So therefore, change of season on one hand, but other relevance is also there, that people believe that, look, I mean, this is the day when we should meet each other, we should greet each other, we should celebrate together.
So, Professor, can Nowruz be used as a way for friendlier communications between India and Pakistan?
Well, Nowruz, you see, there is nobody who can deny the role of festivals in, combining communities together. And as I said earlier, India has been a peaceful and peace-loving country. And India always invites people to participate in festivities. Like, you know, who says that Holi is different from Nowruz? Holi gives similar message, where, you know, we find victory of good over evil. That's a message of Holi festival, where, you know, the bad thing is thrown to the dust. Then they lit fire and they cross, they go across the fire. You see, in Iran, they say Surkhi wa Zardi. Here also they say that, look, I am for good, and let the bad spirit go to the hell. So this is a message. If Pakistan is accepting it, or in Central Asia it is prevalent, I think, well, one should make effort in order to combine the entire community of the world together. And Pakistan is not away from the world community. I mean, Pakistan, and if Pakistan is extending hands in terms of, you see, Indian festivals, if they say they want to celebrate, India will not stop them. You see, India will encourage them.
All right, now that was our special episode about Nowruz and its potential as a vessel of peace and symbol of life. We shall meet next week, and Nowruz Mubarak.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.